Hi, and welcome to the River Talk podcast. This is the, I don't know, one of the best podcasts in the world, if you ask me. I'm not sure if that's the case or not, but I'm pretty sure this is one of the best podcasts in the world where we talk about rafting, kayaking, I don't know, whatever we feel like talking about. I don't know if we even have a main topic other than just rivers.
And we did, Zach, make a list of podcasts.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I guess we are a top contender. I don't know how many river podcasts there are out there, but we made a list.
The internet says we're one of the top 7 rafting podcasts. I'm going to claim we're one of the best podcasts ever. Although, on a side note, I've been listening to Meeting Tom Cruise podcast, which is actually the best podcast ever produced.
Awesome.
But that's on another topic. This is a podcast we try to do weekly with our friend Eric Weiseth, and Priscilla Macy is with me today, where we just, you know, chat. And so this week we have a topic, which is just what to wear boating and on cold days, which we get asked a lot. So we're going to do our best to try to answer it in as many words as we possibly can. But before we get with that, do we have any news of the week, Priscilla?
Yeah, we have a couple things. Some things Zach knows a bit more about than me. First thing, a couple weeks ago, a number of us spent some time talking to Congress people in DC about guide and outfitter issues, as well as just river issues like the Wild and Scenic River Act and Southwest Oregon Watershed and Salmon Protection Act, which we have a little bit of news about now. So it was interesting because normally all of us would be going there physically in person for the most part, but all of these were Zoom calls. And it was interesting, but I thought it was kind of cool because we got to speak face to face with a couple Congress people that I think ordinarily wouldn't have had the ability to do that because of their schedules. So it was kind of cool to talk to some people that we don't normally get FaceTime with.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people think Zoom is bad, and I'm one of them. Maybe, I don't know, like, or they're just like, they've had too much Zoom. I think in this case, it was more effective than a DC visit, and, you know, because we got to bring extra people into certain meetings who couldn't have physically been there.
Yeah.
And yeah, we met 2 members of Congress that, you know, on other trips haven't been able to meet, which was really kind of cool.
Yeah.
So I was pretty jazzed on how it went.
And Will Volpert, one of our friends who owns Indigo Creek Outfitters in Southern Oregon, joined us. And I don't think he's been able to go to DC in person before. So it was cool to be able to have some folks that don't always have the time or opportunity to go physically to DC to do these things, to be able to be a voice and hang out with us. Another news of the week, which Zach, I think, can talk about a little bit more, is the Southwest Oregon Watershed and Salmon Protection Act got a House vote and passed. And it was interesting. I was watching the news on my birthday and watching just very boring news that nobody, unless you're working on legislation, watches, where it was like tallying the votes. And I was like, Southwest Oregon Watershed and Salmon Protection Act. I think I've kind of worked on that with Zach before. And I was like really excited about it, just watching it on the TV. Wait, but
was it its own bill? I thought it was added as part of a bigger package.
I think it was part of a bigger package. They were doing a process, and I can't remember what it was called. It was actually a process I was unfamiliar with. It was like recalling it or something. But I just saw it pop up and I'm like, oh, that's a bill that I recognize the title of. So that was super weird. But Zach, why don't you talk about it? I know one of our representatives was a yes vote, and that was super cool. Representative Peter DeFazio, is that right?
I mean, this all happened because of Peter DeFazio.
Yeah.
Like this would not have gotten to where it's gotten. You know, Representative DeFazio has been a champion for this area for a long time. And the reason we have this, it's called, I'll just call it SAVSPA. Am I saying that? SAVSPA?
SAVSPA. SAVSPA.
This one's a mouthful. The Southern Oregon Watershed and Salmon Protection Act, or SAVSPA. It's legislation to permanently protect Hunter Creek, Rough and Ready Creek, Bald Face Creek, a few places from new mineral entry. And so it's something that started with Senator Wyden. He worked hard to get a 20-year withdrawal from mining. So it's a temporary mineral withdrawal that temporarily protects this area that we fought for and got done administratively and President Obama signed off on that. And that was a massive win. But these temporary mineral withdrawals require legislation. It's like a temporary withdrawal because legislation is coming. And so SOWSPA is that legislation. It's existed for a while. And now that and it's just, it's there, and hopefully someday it would pass and have permanent protection, not just 20 years. And Representative DeFazio saw a moment where he could get it into another conservation bill and slid it in there. And that conservation bill is a massive, really cool bill. And it's looking really good to pass, which would, again, provide protection for these places that I love. Most people haven't paddled these esoteric? Is that the right word? Esoteric creeks?
I can't remember what that word means, but it sounds like it's right.
I'm going to say it because it makes me sound smart.
Too bad Aaron number one isn't here to correct us.
But I'm going to say they're very not very well known for paddlers, and they're difficult to paddle. They find flows and access, but they're places I've personally fallen in love with, and I'm really excited to see them protected. I would really hate to see large scale nickel mining go in, and for a lot of reasons. One of them is that these areas are on this type of serpentine rock called peridotite. That is part of the Earth's mantle. It rarely hits the surface of the Earth. And so this really rare peridotite, these are places where it's hit the surface of the Earth. And we have really cool botany based on it. It's the same geology that's on the North Fork of the Smith and what makes the North Fork of the Smith special. And so we're protecting more places like the North Fork of the Smith. And I'm pretty jazzed on it. So I'll stop talking about it. But
I have a few questions. We'll talk about it a little bit more. So I guess a statement for Hunter Creek and Pistol River, those are both streams that meet the ocean near Gold Beach, Oregon. And so since they meet the ocean, they host anadromous fish. So fish that migrate from saltwater to freshwater, which we talked about with Aaron Lieberman from Idaho Guides and Outfitters, are some of the species that are most threatened and we're wanting to protect. For our own sake, but for the sake of entire ecosystems. And so that's worth pointing out. Obviously we've talked about Rough and Ready Creek and how special and unique that place is as well. But something I want to ask you, since some of the feedback that we often deal with is, well, what's this going to actually affect? And in the legislation, it mentions what's not going to be affected. And I think that's important to point out too, is that it won't affect or restrict existing recreation uses, hunting, fishing, forest management, or other authorized uses that are allowed upon the enactment of the act. So Zach, maybe you can talk a little bit about that. So what about someone who lives down there that is engaged in, has a mining right, or a historical mining right or water right, is that going to affect them?
No, I mean, I'm not a lawyer or a mining expert, but I'm going to tell you my the best I know about this. They can't make new mining claims. So if they have an existing mining claim, this doesn't take it away. But they also, if they have an existing mining claim, they have to show that their mining claim is valid, which is a term that says it's going to produce. If they just have a mining claim, but it doesn't actually have the mineral on it, that could be taken away. They have to prove that there's actually minerals worth mining to use it.
Okay.
So existing mining claims have to be valid. And then this won't allow for any new mining claims. So if a big corporation comes in and wants to, use the 1872 mining law to just make claims everywhere, that won't be allowed.
Okay.
And they can't do it now because we have the 20-year temporary withdrawal.
But when that expires, that could change. And so this this is a way to reinforce something that's already passed, but to not make it temporary.
Yeah, this goes from temporary to permanent. And what the last one didn't really pass anything. President Obama did it under an executive order.
Administrative executive action.
So the idea is, he said, hey, I think these places should be protected, and there's legislation, permanent legislation. While that passes, I'm going to put a temporary ban, right? So the idea of his administrative order that he can do allows a temporary ban while we wait for the legislation to pass. And sometimes these are usually 5-year things. And this happened on the Chetco with the Chetco. I forget the Chetco bill that we got through a few years ago. But the 5-year, it was like 4 years and 10 months or something. And then the bill barely got passed in time. And so this one was 20 because we knew it might take longer. And luckily Representative DeFazio is getting a push through, hopefully, or he's worked hard to help us on this one.
Yeah, it sounds like a common sense thing to do that minimizes adverse impacts to already existing activities and makes it so that these places can continue to thrive and be restored in the future. Well, probably enough of that for now. If you guys want us to talk more about legislation, send us a note. We're happy to do it, but we don't want to bore probably most of our listeners.
Let me add one more thing on this really quick. I'm not somebody who's like, let's protect everything all the time. I'm sort of a moderate. And so you can make the case that let's protect every river everywhere. And I get that case. I'm going to say for this one, these places are uniquely special to the world. These are deserving of protection just because they exist. So for me, this is one where like they're so special, we should fight to protect them.
Yeah.
And so this isn't just like, you know, my hippie hat coming on saying protect rivers, which I believe in. This is a real place that's special and deserving of protection just because it exists and is threatened by large scale nickel mining. And so this is an important one.
Yeah, agreed. And the Pistol River is kind of an incredible and unique whitewater run as well. Not many people get to visit it because of flows and the access is a little bit tricky. But it's just, it's really cool. It's one of those streams where I think you ordinarily see this kind of thing in California, where there's just these larger than life boulders and crystal clear water. And you're just like, holy smokes, this river can hold so much water and we're running it like at a flow that seems good, but it's like low compared to what the stream bed can hold. And I don't know, I think it's kind of awe inspiring. And Hunter Creek is just super steep and incredible. And we haven't paddled it, but have looked at it and know that it Hunter Creek and Pistol River are both well coveted by anglers as well. So
yep,
lots of interest. On that vein, real quickly, I know we talked about it briefly, but for the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, I know that the group that we work with, the Wild and Scenic River Coalition, which is a group of a ton of people across the state, have been kind of having to respond to questions and information about private property rights and water rights and how the legislation would affect it. Our understanding is that it's not going to affect existing property rights or existing water rights. So do you have an elevator pitch to quickly explain that as we've been responding to these complaints and interests over the past few weeks?
Well, I mean, when you designate a river wild and scenic, it's typically on public land. So there isn't private land. The only time you do it on private land is with permission of the private landowners. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pretty sure like all of Senator Wyden's proposals in this River Democracy Act are all on public lands.
Yeah. And I know through the process, there was a couple that were proposed that I'm thinking of the South Umpqua watershed that just didn't really meet the test because there was too much private property and that wasn't really our goal for this legislation. So I know there was a number of streams that were proposed that kind of got filtered out because it seemed insurmountable to get permission from every single property owner in the segment.
Oh, so it's crazy.
I think they did a good job of ensuring and filtering as much as they could to make sure that these streams were primarily on federal, state, already publicly owned areas.
Yeah, I would be surprised if there's anything with public land in that bill, just because it's so hard to get it. Or private land, yeah. And you know, whenever a river is on private land, it becomes wild and scenic. It's called a partnership river. That's the term for it. And it's a lot of this back east because there isn't much public land back east. So a lot of the wild and scenic rivers back east are these partnership rivers where they had to get all the landowners to agree ahead of time to accept the wild and scenic designation before it even went through as a possible bill. So I don't think that anything with private land will go through. And there may be sections where there's public land and it goes through a little bit of private land and then back to public land. they'll just exclude that part of public land from the designation. So it shouldn't affect
private land. Yeah.
Hey, I keep saying that wrong. Sorry. There shouldn't be anything on private land affected by wild and scenic designations, unless the private landowners are cool with it. You have, it's, you know, they have to agree to it. If they're cool with it, then it's fine. Mm-hmm. But if you own private land along a river, this isn't going to change. This shouldn't change anything.
Yeah. Well, great, great summary and clarification. Our last little news of the week is a number of guide and outfitter associations in multiple states and national organizations. Last week, we signed on to a letter sent to the Western State Congressional delegations saying that we are supportive of Representative Simpson's proposal and plan for the removal of the Snake River dams. And I think it's cool to see so many different states, even ones that don't have the dams in their state, say, yes, this is important. This is a good plan that recognizes all the complexities of this removal and wants to address a good way that provides a benefit to all. And we're looking forward to continuing to work as a group and work with Representative Mike Simpson and others on figuring out just what this plan is going to look like in reality.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm so glad to hear. I'm so proud that outfitting associations are behind this. It just makes me proud to be to do my job as an outfitter, to be part of that.
Yeah.
Such a big deal. And for those of you who don't know, Representative Simpson is an Idaho representative and a Republican, you know, mm-hmm. which is really cool. Like, a Republican sees the value of keeping salmon and steelhead in Idaho. And he's put together a big plan that probably a lot of Republicans are against. And he's putting himself out there. It's that important.
And I think what's really cool about this plan is often when we're dealing with natural resource issues and especially problems that we've caused ourselves as humans by building things in a time when maybe we didn't recognize the impacts they were going to cause, is he's like, well, this is going to impact communities. How do we address that? How do we make it so it's not just narrow visioned, where it's really taking into account just how difficult of a problem it is on the human side, on the environment side, and on the hopefully saving a species or multiple species that are facing extinction. So it's really cool to see a comprehensive plan and really impressive the work that's went into it thus far.
Yep. And this is something, again, like going back to like Rough and Ready Creek, I'm like, we should, you know, it's so special. We should protect it. We maybe can't protect everything. And it probably sounds like we're like, protect this, protect this, protect this. This is one, again, where the salmon and steelhead are so special and they're threatened,
mm-hmm.
right? This is an example of where like there's actually a threat here, you know, and I think it's important that we address it. I've always known about salmon and steelhead from like reading brochures and watching videos that Patagonia makes or whatever. And I've always known about them. I'm doing this online course about salmon and steelhead, the Idaho Rivers United, made for river guides. And I've been reading about salmon and steelhead and I've learned so much I didn't even know. Like every time I read through this, I learn more and more about how unique and special they are. And so I'll put a link to that course in the show notes. If anybody else wants to take it, it's a lot of reading, but man, they are fascinating fish. It's just very mind cool. blowing how cool they are. And the fact that they evolved, I know we say this all the time, but they go from their home in the Idaho mountains all the way to the ocean. They like miss shark attacks and kill, I don't
orcas
know what
it is, orcas sea lions.
A bunch of them die out there. And then they go, let's turn around and go back to where we were born and lay eggs. They have to go all the way back up in the Idaho mountains, like create a red, like, you know, lay eggs, meet a male and have more of them. And then repeat, which without dams seems like hard enough.
Yeah.
And then you throw like, I think it's 7 dams in the way. It's crazy.
And you know, it's something I learned that's even, I guess I didn't I knew they were dedicated species to their task, but they showed this clip, I think it was on the Elwha, where they were just hitting their heads on the dam, like trying to get up there. And it's like, oh my gosh, like they're so committed to what they are supposed to do.
Yeah. So, the more I learn about this, the more passionate I become about how important this is.
Same.
I just this is such a unique species. And I'm not a biologist, so I shouldn't say anything about biology, but I'm going to try anyway. And if I'm completely wrong here, somebody please say this to me. I feel like when I do the Rogue, there's tons of wildlife. Mm-hmm. It's just tons of wildlife. It's like a zoo. When we do the Middle Fork, there's wildlife, but it's not like the Rogue. And I wonder if part of that reason is that there aren't the same salmon and steelhead returns there were historically. And that if salmon and steelhead were returned to somewhat normal conditions, if we'd be seeing bears everywhere and more bighorn sheep and elk, and it would be more of a zoo on the Middle Fork if the fish were returned back. So I don't know the answer. I probably shouldn't even ask the question because I'm not a biologist, but it makes me think that there was even more wildlife there before the numbers started dropping.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad conclusion. Like Aaron was saying, the salmon are such an and steelhead are such an integral part of the ecosystem, from, you know, trees and plants using the nutrients, yeah, which are then passed on to herbivores, which are then eaten by carnivores. So
yeah,
it's incredible. And I do have a correction. It was anadromous fish. I knew I pronounced it wrong. Anadromous fish, which are fish that migrate up rivers from sea to spawn. So that's the terminology of the day. So we should probably move on to our main topic. So our main topic, what to wear on the water, primarily oriented towards beginners or people just getting into the sport and people that maybe just do a few trips a year, not people that are paddling every weekend or, you know, a few times per month, rain or shine. This topic was inspired by a couple questions I got from friends and from a colleague of Jacob's who is embarking on a spring multi-day trip on the John Day. And the question was, well, what kind of footwear do I wear? Do I wear waterproof socks? Do I wear wool socks? Do I wear neoprene socks and shoes? Do I wear neoprene booties? And it kind of embarked this thought train of, well, there really isn't a great resource or guide for folks that, you know, get invited on a trip and they're not sure what to wear, or people that are just getting into the sport and maybe don't have a bunch of money to spend on a dry suit. So I figure we can talk about the basics, and then I can help answer this question for a friend about the John Day on the podcast. hopefully not add confusion to the question. But I think, you know, starting from the very basics, like, what kind of craft are you paddling? How, like, are you going to be paddleboarding? Are you going to be IKing? Are you going to be wet all the time? Are you going to be sitting on a raft? Those all kind of change the decision-making framework. Are you in the Pacific Northwest? Are you in California? Is your trip in the Grand Canyon in the spring where it might be really cold? Or is your trip, you know, in California where the weather is warm, but maybe the nights are cold? So I figure we can try to tackle this as best as we can, starting from the basics. So Zach, cool. Let's maybe we could start by doing footwear and then working our way through base layers and like wetsuit / splash top / dry options.
Are we gonna focus on cold weather or just all weather?
I figure it's helpful. Most people I would say start their paddling in not super cold weather. I mean, that's how I started. And a lot of the people that I know that I've gotten questions are wondering what to wear on a spring or summer trip. So I guess we can orient our speaking towards spring, because summer's pretty easy to tell people what to wear. Yeah. Cool. And footwear, you know, like being safe, we can talk about that. But spring, where the weather's not terrible, maybe think about an Illinois spring trip where it's, you know,
perfect.
But you don't want people to be getting cold because the water's cold.
So for I consider shoes part of PPE, personal protective equipment. It's not just a thing you wear. It's actually protects you. So I'm a fan of shoes that stay on your feet, and which is big. So if some people are flip flops, that's not going to be okay. And I'm going to choose shoes over sandals myself, just having seen so many foot injuries due to sandals.
Yeah.
And I feel like with Astrals, you really can't go wrong. Astrals are, you know, whatever. The Brewers are nice because you can wear them to the bar after you go paddle. Or, but there's the Wrestlers cover your ankles. So that's kind of nice. But Astral has a shoe for everything. And then you want grip. You want a grip on wet rock. And so the Astrals have good soles. So yeah. I'm going to say personally, good shoes that have good grip on wet rock.
Yeah. And drainability and dry, I guess, how quickly they dry out too. Tennis shoes are often made of nylon and some cotton blend, and they take forever to dry yeah. out. So I would think about that if you're, especially if you're doing a multi-day where you're gonna have to put those shoes on again in the morning after they've been cold and wet. And like Zach said, the grip is so important. And I, guiding in the summer, I used to wear Chacos, and I'm clumsy, so this isn't a good rule for everyone, but I broke my toe at least twice just by smashing it on rocks and running around. So maybe if you wore a neoprene sock and Chacos, that wouldn't be as bad, but I ended up using shoes or sandals that have at least toe protection because I realized I was hurting my feet so much. The other thing is, not to bash on Keen, they make incredible shoes, but there are certain types of rubber that don't work that well with wet rocks. So like hardened rubber or thick rubber that might work for really well for hiking sometimes end up being pretty bad for slippery rocks, which are often around rivers. So when you're looking for a shoe or investing in a shoe, definitely seek out the ones that are intended for wet environments, not only for drying and draining, but also for the grip on the shoe itself.
I think like Keens are fine if you're doing the main salmon, you're in the sand or the Grand Canyon, but if you're on like the middle fork of the salmon or to jump around on wet rocks, or you're running harder rivers, I think the Keens are not quite adequate for harder stuff. But for most like class three, probably the Rogue Keens are fine, stuff like that. But because they have the protection, because that's the trade-off. Would you, if you had to choose one or the other, foot protection or gripping on rocks, which one would you pick?
I'd probably pick the grip on rocks, because I know that's where most of the injuries I've seen happen and the injuries or accidents that I've had personally is just from, you know, thinking my shoe's grippy and then slipping and falling or seeing other people do the same thing. And as a good affordable option for beginners, I do like what NRS makes and other companies make is the neoprene bootie that has a bit more of a robust sole and toe protection. Because if your feet are getting wet, it provides good insulation. And then, you know, it's just an all-in-one, which is really good. Again, as long as you are able to dry them out at camp and it's not super cold at night where you're having to put on frozen booties in the morning, because that's unpleasant.
Let me tell you about the super expensive option.
All right.
I'm pretty stoked on this. Arc'teryx makes a lightweight running shoe called the Norvin SL. And it's not river specific, but it's mostly mesh. And it dries out really fast. And they're stupid comfortable. They don't grip on rock as well as an Astral, but they're pretty close. And so I got a pair last year and I'm pretty stoked on them. And one of the reasons is that river shoes are going to wear out fast. It's just how it is. Like people, you know, say the Astrals fall apart fast and they do, but any shoe that gets wet and dry and wet and dry and wet and dry is going to fall apart. It's almost impossible to make a durable shoe. And I feel like the Arc'teryx shoe has lasted me a long time. Like I bet it has twice the durability of an Astral. Based on the materials they use and how it's connected. And it's not even meant as a water shoe. So you're going to pay double for it, but it will last twice as long. And so I've been really digging that shoe a lot, but it's awesome. It's expensive.
Yeah. And another option that I recently have found is nice, especially if you're just rafting or in a hard shell kayak where your feet and you're not planning to jump out into, you know, over ankle deep water a lot. is the waterproof socks. There's a number of companies that make them now. Is I'll wear waterproof socks with my Astrals or whatever. And then my feet, and they're pretty well insulated as well. So if your feet get cold, you could add a wool sock under the waterproof sock and then put a shoe on. But I really like having my feet dry as much as possible. And if you're just sitting in a raft where you think you'll have, you know, an inch of water over your feet, it's a great way to keep your feet dry and then not deal with having the wet, cold neoprene when you're not in water. So let's talk about layers. So we all know cotton's terrible unless you are in an extremely hot environment.
Slow down. I love cotton. I almost always wear a cotton t-shirt under my dry suit.
Well, but that's under your dry suit. Remember, okay, beginners and a couple times a year's paddlers probably won't want to spend $800+ on a dry suit.
Yeah. So then if you're trying to stay warm, you definitely don't want to wear cotton.
But if you're starting to stay cool, like if you're guiding on the Cal Salmon when it's 100 degrees, I don't know if that ever happens. Maybe you do want.
It happens.
Okay. Or the lower salmon in Idaho paddling when it's over 100 degrees, the water's not cold. Cotton's great to keep you cool. But overall, you probably want a base layer that is a synthetic material, so like polyester, nylon, polypropylene, rayon, or some sort of blend. And additionally, if you can, some sort of wicking fabric is helpful. If you get sweaty like I do, or you want your skin to stay dry as you get warmer and the water starts to evaporate, the synthetic fabrics typically do a really good job of that. And there's other fabric technologies like, I'm forgetting the name of it. I think Adidas originally came up with it, but it's similar to Gore-Tex where the moisture, it's like a one-way thing where the moisture leaves your body and might stay on the outside of the shirt, but the inside of your body should be relatively dry compared to the outside of the layer, which is really nice.
I'm a big fan of wool. I do. I have a lot of
wool. Wool's awesome. Yeah.
And there's a couple key reasons. It doesn't stink unless you're really stinky, but for most people it doesn't stink.
And Polypro does, and it never gets unstinky. Yep.
And wool doesn't melt up next to a fire. Wool's actually fire retardant, where synthetic will burn. So if you're drying your stuff out by the fire or you're just by a fire, wool's kind of nice for some fire properties.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so if you're wearing these layers and you want to keep relatively dry, a good option are, you know, rain pants or a raincoat if you're in a raft. You know, that's an obvious choice that a lot of people already own, so you don't have to buy new gear. But there are splash pants and splash paddles that are splash pants and splash paddle tops that have a little bit more of kind of Velcro straps. Some of them have semi gaskets to help keep more water out. So those are also good options if you're in a raft. If you're in an IK, maybe not the best option, especially if you're going to be swimming around, because that just makes a balloon of water around your body and you're not going to be better off. So if you're in IK, it changes a little bit more. You might want to invest in dry pants or just do a Farmer John wetsuit or a surfer wetsuit, so that you're staying warm, even though you're going to be wet more of the time. Do you have any other things that you'd recommend for rafting or IKing?
I think it's important. The rule of the air temperature and the water temperature being above or below 120, then you may be below 120, wear a wetsuit or a dry suit. I've moved that to 140. I really feel like if it's below 140 combined air and water temperature, wetsuit or dry suit, above that, you probably still should think about it, but maybe not mandatory. But I want to say the biggest thing I worry about is if you fall out in the cold water, an initial cold water response. Mm-hmm. And there's different things that cold water response can do, but it can be fatal. And so at least having your body covered so that when you fall out of the water, that you don't have a quick cold shock, that there's a little bit of time. Now, those of us that jump into a kayak all the time, we're used to that cold shock. And so we've adapted to it. But if you've never had that, this is super important. So like, even if like your friend who's really experienced doesn't have, is wearing shorts and a t-shirt, they're accustomed to it. You may not be if you're new to this. And that cold shock, again, there's multiple ways it can be potentially deadly. And so I think it's really important that we're covered. And I think a wetsuit or dry suit are key, but like what you said about a jacket and pants is sort of a minimum thing. And then if you take a long swim, then the worry is hypothermia and just loss of like dexterity, because you'll get worn out fast. Like if you swim more than a minute without a dry suit and cold water, you're going to lose energy to keep swimming. And so there's two mechanisms. One is the initial cold shock, and the two is the long swim. You know, are you going to kind of like freeze up in a way? And so I think that's where having a wetsuit or a dry suit keeps your core temperature going. So you, if you go for a long swim, you're still able to function, basically.
Yeah. And a couple other things that I've learned over time that are helpful, especially if you're doing a spring trip, say you're doing a multi-day rafting trip in the spring with your friends, it's nice to, you know, outside of your overnight bag, which is usually tied onto the raft and not super easily accessible, have a little dry bag that has maybe a couple layers, couple of extra socks. If you get cold during the day, you could change them out during lunch. If your hands get really cold, having a pair of gloves, you know, they could just be little wool mittens if you're sitting on a raft, or you could invest in like neoprene gloves if you want to, but and maybe a beanie. Those things all make a big difference when you start to get cold around lunchtime on a spring trip, or, you know, some clouds roll in or some rain rolls in. And those are all really easy to do. And you can get a small, you know, day dry bag for pretty cheap at most outdoor retailers.
Yeah. I just, as I think about this, when it's cold, a wetsuit's so important. And so if anybody's going to invest into anything, I would invest into a Farmer John wetsuit.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they're almost all sold out right now. I went to go buy some for our spring trips, and you can't even buy them because of the supply chain issues right now. So, I mean, just getting one is difficult. And if comfort's important to you, getting a dry suit, which it's expensive, it's, you know, $500 to $1,000+. But there's also places that rent them. So if you're going to just do like a 5-day trip once a year, you know, Immersion Research has some for rent, and you can call them. I think they ship it to you, and you can ship it back maybe.
Yeah, and I think they do.
I'm not sure. I shouldn't talk about things that I know they know.
I know, but they have renter suits, and they actually do have a supply of Farmer John wetsuits, at least last I knew, a couple weeks. So you could go there or go online or call them and ask about it. There's various other, sometimes rafting companies, not all of them will have rental gear too. It just depends on their size and their inventory, but it's worth checking out and figuring out well before your trip if that's an option. I think I did that for a Cal Salmon and Klamath trip in the spring when it was really cold, and I was so tired of wearing a wetsuit and being cold in the morning and having to like deal with the frozen wetsuit in the morning that I just rented a dry suit, and I ended up buying a dry suit the next year because I was like, well, this changes everything.
It's definitely, it's way more comfortable. And so I think people could rent them is a good option, but I want to point out, I do love wetsuits. I think there's a place for wetsuits, and they're affordable. They're durable. You can, you know, if you jump in, you can cool off. Or if you need to cool off, you can. I've had some issues with dry suits, like people that don't know how to use them or don't use them often or rent them. I have had people who aren't used to them not zip them up completely because they don't know. Break a gasket. The zippers break. And if the zippers break, the dry suit is kind of a danger, actually. Right? Yeah. If you can't close the zipper, then you maybe have nothing, or you're in a danger. And the reason it's dangerous is if it fills with water, you're not going to sink. You're just, your mass increases. And so if you have to swim to shore, it's really hard to move your mass plus all the water in the suit toward shore. And, you know, there's been examples of people having fatalities because they couldn't get to shore in a full dry suit. So The one thing to be careful of with dry suits is just that they can break.
Yep.
And so nowadays on commercial trips where people have dry suits, I'm throwing in extra wetsuits, just expecting them to break.
And that's a good point you bring up too, is if you're thinking of buying a dry suit and find a good one that's used for a good deal, make sure it's in good condition. But it's also worth having it pressure tested, because it's really worthless if it's not working. It's kind of in some ways worse than just wearing a rain jacket and splash pants, because you know, you're expecting something to work and all of a sudden you're just in a soggy suit.
Mm-hmm. I went paddling the other day actually, and I have my favorite dry suit, my second favorite dry suit, and I hadn't worn my second favorite in a while, and I forgot there was a leak on the arm. I do love wearing cotton under my dry suit. And so my arm, like throughout the day, my arm was just like a constant drip of cold water. And at the end of the day, my whole sleeve was soaking wet, and I froze the second half of the day because my second favorite dry suit has a leaky arm.
Oh man. Well, so without getting into technical equipment, cause that goes down a wormhole and it totally depends on what activity you're doing, but maybe we can try to specifically answer Jacob's friend's question about what footwear to wear on a spring multi-day on the John Day. Neoprene, waterproof socks, wool, shoes, a combination of those things. What would those be? My recommendation was, you know, it of course depends on how much water you think you're going to be exposing yourself to. So if you're just sitting in a raft, you have a couple inches of water in the boat, like normal. Maybe the dry socks, and if it's cold, wool socks underneath the dry socks and some sort of shoe that has good grip. If your feet are going to be wet all day, neoprene and maybe wool for extra insulation with regular shoes. And then just, if you can, dry the neoprene out by the fire at night so they're not terribly cold or frozen in the morning. Do you have any suggestions?
I've never heard of this dry sock thing. Can you explain this to me? How does it stay? So does it have a gasket?
It's a multi-layer sock, and it's some type of plastic layer, but it's totally machine washable. I've washed mine a number of times. So it has like regular sock, stretchy material, some combination of synthetic, and then it has a waterproof layer, some sort of plastic or something, and then another normal sock layer. And so I've used them a number of times for hiking, mountain biking, and paddling. And I found as long as you're not submerging the sock above where the top of it is, so, you know, above your ankle.
Got it. They're waterproof, they stay dry. unless you go for a swim.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So if you're rafting and doing something mellow, like the lower sections of the John Day, and, you know, you might be stepping in puddles or stepping in puddles in your raft, that seems like a good option. And especially
if you swim, will they fill with water?
No. So they're pretty skin tight. Obviously, you can get them in bigger sizes if you want, but they don't fill with water. There's just some moisture that goes down the top of the sock, so they're no longer totally waterproof. But they're not like neoprene booties where sometimes if you swim, you get like the big puddle in them. They have to drain out.
Who makes them?
So I bought mine at Next Adventure. There's a number of brands that make them. I think they sell them at REI and
you can just Google waterproof socks. I shouldn't even ask you. I'll just Google it right now and find out.
I think they started as an innovation for hikers that were hiking in muddy areas, which makes sense.
It seems that your feet like
stay dry.
It seems like that may not, like your feet aren't going to breathe. Like I hear about a lot of plastic here and that your feet may not breathe.
Well, they're surprisingly breathable, and I should have done more research into the technology, but, you know, less breathable than just a normal sock, obviously, because if they were super breathable, then water would also get in. But I didn't find my feet to get like super sweaty or anything like that. They just were totally dry at the end of the day, as long as I wasn't kind of submerging my entire leg in the water.
So I just Googled it and I'm down a rabbit hole. So I'm not going to stop this rabbit hole. But my answer to your friend who's going to do the John Day is just get neoprene socks. Or as I was Googling it, found like there's NRS Hydro Skin socks.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe like that. But you know, my recommendation, it's like simple and cheap, is like, just use a pair of old beater running shoes and throw some neoprene socks in. You're probably good. You're not going to get the grip on the rock with your old running shoes, but
that might not be an issue on John Day.
Yeah, it's a John Day. I'm not super worried about jumping all over rocks. It's more, you know, that's not that kind of river. And so that's the simple, easy thing is neoprene socks are great. Mm-hmm. I've used them a bunch, and your feet don't stay dry with them, but they stay warm-ish, depending how cold it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I advised in an email to him, you know, if your feet do get cold, just have accessible some extra wool socks, and, you know, that'll warm them up pretty quickly. And, you know, dry out the neoprene by the fire if you can. And if you want to invest in the waterproof socks, those are a good option too. But yeah, I think the most basic recommendation would be the neoprene socks and carry some extra socks to keep your feet warm if they get cold.
Yep. I like the neoprene socks again because they're durable. Like if you have to walk on them around camp in the sand for some, you shouldn't, but if you did, you're not going to like trash them.
Yeah.
You know, they're very durable. You can use them for other stuff. They're like $25 and they're very useful.
Yeah. Cool. Well, do we have any other quick tips without going down the rabbit hole for?
Well, I think the rabbit hole I want to go down really quick is dry suits, because that's what people keep asking me is like, what dry suit do I get? You know, I don't want to spend a lot of money, but I also want to get something good. Like if people do want to buy dry suits, what's let's talk about an introductory level dry suit, and then like the River Pro, like what would you get? If you're like, I boat 100 days a year, what's really good? And then just like, I would use it for like 2 or 3 private trips a year. I want the basics.
Well, NRS and Immersion Research both offer pretty affordable entry level dry suits, which are great options. Both of them have pretty good warranties and repair programs. So, depending on what you're looking for, check out Immersion Research and NRS. I've found NRS's dry suits to be more durable from all levels, which is really nice. NRS, has been improving their design, and their recent design seems pretty good. What I look for most, which is, you know, hard to do unless you're able to try them on, is the fit of the dry suit. And that was something I had to learn over the years, is you don't want it to fit like normal clothing. You want to be able to move around in it, but you don't want it so big that you're losing the ability to stay warm. So I find I have to go a size or two up, because I have broad shoulders for a woman, and for women's sizing, it's typically a narrower fit. And so I have to always try them on when I'm getting a new suit. But if you're just, you know, a standard sized human that can generally order sizes online, then they work for you. I would think about ordering a size up, but if you are able to, go try it on, because the fit can really make or break a trip.
Going to NRS suits, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, every NRS suit I knew leaked a day after use. I think historically they're pretty bad, but I asked some friends recently about their NRS suits and they're pretty happy with them.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're hearing the same thing, that the NRS is, their suits are actually going to be pretty good.
Yeah. And I talked to some of the folks over at NRS, and it sounds like they have made some significant design changes and fabric changes to try to meet the demands, which is great. I think IR, for many years now, has done a really good job of that. And if you're going to be trashing a suit, you know, they have the Devil's Club option, which is super thick. And, you know, Jacob has put it through the ringer and is very happy with it. The other thing about dry suits that I just thought of is bathroom. So if you're a girl, think about like how you want to go to the bathroom. And if you need a drop seat, or if you want a dry suit where you can use a funnel. If you're a guy, then the options are pretty simple, unless you wanted to buy a drop seat suit so that you could go poo without taking your dry suit off. You could get creative.
Is that a thing?
No, I'm trying to make it a thing. I want to call it the poop suit.
No, I don't know if I'm into that.
But Yeah. And then, you know, if you're getting a dry suit and you're thinking about bathroom stuff and that sort of thing, think about the layers you're wearing under it. And if that makes things difficult as well. But yeah, I think the biggest tip for dry suit is, you know, if you're buying it used, make sure you get it pressure tested. If you've never bought one before or you're buying from a new company, if there's a way for you to try it on, I would absolutely do that. Or maybe speak with the customer and order two sizes and ask if you can ship one back.
Oh, that's interesting. I just Googled dry suits. There's an NRS dry suit that's $700. This seems pretty basic, but it looks like it would generally work. And the least expensive IR one looks like $1,000.
Okay.
Although I've seen them have sales on them sometimes too.
They do. Yeah. If you check, I think they call it their garage or something like that.
Yeah.
They have suits that were maybe demos or were used once by a paddler and then returned, where you can get them for really cheap. And, you know, if you call Immersion Research or NRS, sometimes they have stuff in the back room. You could ask if they have any special deals.
what do you got in the back for a deal?
Yeah. Do you have any used suits or anything like that, or repaired suits that someone didn't want to, you know, keep, or, you know, those sorts of things.
And I'm with you on fit. Fit is tough for dry suits, because I think it's hard for the manufacturers too, because they can't make like a one size fits all bodysuit for extra large. Yeah. For it's really hard for them. Yeah. And so I know Kokatat, one of my suits is a Kokatat where I had them custom make it. They can make the arms a little bit longer, and you can get a very custom sizing with Kokatat, which is a really cool thing that they
offer.
But
it's obviously more expensive. But
it's expensive. The Kokatats are going to be expensive.
But if you're willing to spend a bunch of money, it might be worth taking your measurements and getting that custom suit, and it'll last forever.
And I have one Immersion Research suit that fits me perfectly. Whatever they did on that suit, it fits me perfectly. So like, I've looked at other Immersion Research ones and they fit me a little weird, but this one is just my very favorite. And I've had it repaired like 3 or 4 times, you know, and they don't make that cut anymore. Mm-hmm. But if they did, I would buy another one, because I love the way that specific one fits me.
Awesome. Well, cool. I think those are our quick tips and tricks. If we missed anything or anyone else has any good tips for beginner paddlers that are maybe doing their first multi-day, or people that just do it a couple times a year, please send them our way.
Yeah, this is a tough issue. It's hard to know, you know, this seems pretty straightforward, right? How to dress for cold weather. Have some good fleece or wool, top and bottom. Protect yourself from getting splashed. Mm-hmm. And wear good shoes.
And have the other thing, if you're doing a multi-day, it's awesome to have camp shoes that are super easy to use. Fan of Crocs, because you can wear socks with them. And you don't have to, like, untie laces or whatever. You have to go to the bathroom in the night. So thinking about your future self is always a good thing on multi-days.
Yeah, well, you definitely want separate camp shoes, 100%. You don't want to wear your shoes that are wet in the evening. Yeah. That's for sure. And Crocs are like a lightweight, simple thing to do. Not the best for hiking. So if you're going to go hikes, you probably want some hiking shoes or some running shoes or something. But around camp, nothing beats Crocs in my mind. They grip on rock okay, but
they
not
do
great.
Pretty well. Well, yeah. Our friend Ben McKenzie has rock climbed stuff that I would not be willing to climb without a rope in them, but wow. He's an outlier. Sweet. Well, should we move on to gear of the week?
Let's do it.
All right. Well, with the theme of ours, my gear of the week is the Immersion Research Thick Skin Onesie. I think I said for myself it was my favorite gear a while back, but Jacob recently got the men's version of the Thick Skin Onesie, and I don't think he was like, this is going to be awesome. He's like, this is going to be way too warm for me, because he runs pretty warm. But he has concluded that it's his favorite onesie he's ever had. What he originally said was like, oh, it fits really tight. I don't know if I like that. He ended up really liking that because it's stretchy and not, it says it's a, you know, thick skin onesie. It's actually not that thick, but it's really warm. And great for, you know, colder spring days, and definitely awesome for winter. And, you know, if you're a person unlike me that doesn't get cold and need like 100 layers to do it in the winter, that could be your one layer under your dry suit and you wouldn't feel too bulky. So
I'm all about the onesie. I saw that thick skin on the website the other day and thought, is that too thick?
No,
so it's good to hear
the men's
not.
Version. Well, their new versions are actually a bit thinner and I feel like they're a bit warmer. I like mine's like the original thick skin, which is really thick, which is perfect for me because I get super cold. But the thick skin they have now, especially the men's, is like actually surprisingly thin, which is super nice. Cool. What's your gear of the week?
My gear of the week is the Petzl Tiblok. Do you know what that
thing
is?
Yep. We have a couple in our emergency kit.
Okay. Everybody tells me you should get a Tiblok. You should use a Tiblok. And so I got one to check it out and it's cool. I just don't know what I'd use it for.
So I don't even know if we have used it. You can use it for a mechanical advantage as long as, well, actually the load could be quite large. And you can use it for ascending as well.
So if as an emergency ascender, I see the value. I feel like I read about it and at larger loads, it will tear the sheet.
So if you're unpinning like a gearboat, I don't think I would use it. But if you're using a mechanical advantage to maybe haul a boat uphill if you need to, or like a kayak or
What I don't get. Why not use a Prusik? I guess I want to know, like, why not just use a Prusik over this Tiblok thing?
Maybe the advantage would be if you used a Prusik and that if you needed two redirections.
Why not two Prusiks? Like, why buy this $50 thing? I'm showing Priscilla on the video. Why have this $50 metal thing when you could have a $12 Prusik?
You probably wouldn't need it. I think the reason we have it is for ascending, which is nice.
Like if you're in a like cliffed out kayaking and somebody drops a rope and you have to climb out, but you can use a Prusik for that too.
That's true. But so how I do ascending is, well, I've used an ascender scouting a creek, so if you know you're going to be ascending, just bring an ascender. It's a much better tool. It's nice with the Tiblok. You're not using the length of your Prusik. You can use the length of your Prusik a portion of the ascender. So think of a couple of the Tiblocks, like you could attach a Prusik or length of rope to it and use it to help hoist yourself up. That's kind of nice because obviously with a Prusik, you're using a significant length of it. So you'd need a lot of them to be able to ascend potentially.
And it's harder. This is my thing too. It's harder to move a Prusik up a rope. Like
that too. Yeah.
For me, so if you're ascending a lot, I could see the value. But for me, I ascend once a lifetime.
Yeah.
Right. Like that. I haven't had to climb a rope out of a canyon ever. Mm-hmm. But let's say it's going to happen someday. I'm like, boy, it sure would be nice to have a Tiblok.
Yeah.
But the Prusik's going to work fine for me, right? Where I guess I can see if you're just like regular, like, hey, we ascend out once a week or like once a month, this thing would be kind of nice to have because it's small. It fits anywhere.
The size and weight is definitely nice. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that lives in our emergency kit in the same way that like a EpiPen would you hope to never use it, but the one time you need it, it's so lightweight that it's nice to have, but it is expensive. So if you're doing roadside runs or you're never going to find yourself in that scenario, then maybe don't spend the $50. Just have a more basic kit with rope. But our safety kit is a little more catered to the scenarios we've found ourselves in.
There's the super in the middle of nowhere safety kits that are different than mine, which is like a headlamp and a cell phone. But I guess the point I want to make is, for mechanical advantage, I wouldn't suggest using this. After I've read more about it, there's a YouTube video that shows it of it being loaded super heavy and tearing the sheath off the rope.
It will do that. And for listeners that don't know what the Tiblok is, it has these tiny little aluminum teeth that is what grabs the rope. So you'd have to look at what it's rated to, and then determine.
It's actually not that high. When I looked into it,
I figured not.
I was like, wow, it isn't as much as I thought it was based on how many people recommend it. So my gear of the week is just saying, I don't think the two block is a good thing for most boaters. And if somebody has a different opinion, I want to hear it because I want to learn. So please leave us a comment on the website or send me a nasty email, whatever you want to do. But I'm after researching some playing with it, I think that maybe we should stick to Prussic in general and not two blocks.
Yeah. And you can buy Prussic by the yard at REI or probably at Home Depot.
you can use any accessory cord to do a Prussic. Mm-hmm. But I've been using these Sterling auto blocks and Sterling hollow blocks, and they're just so easy to work with. And there's no knot, they're sewn together. So it's just easier. You don't have that big double fisherman's in the way. And so I am a massive fan of these like $12 Sterling, either the auto block or the hollow block, and they're made to grip. So normally, sorry to go on a tangent, I've been teaching this a lot lately, so it's in my brain. Normally a Prussic is half the diameter. The Prussic cord is half the diameter of the rope you're going to use it on. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you have a 12 meter static line, you typically want about a 6 millimeter Prussic. But when we're doing rescue, sometimes we're using a 12 millimeter static line. Sometimes we're using the 8 millimeter throw bag, sometimes a 9 millimeter throw bag. And so you may have to have all these different Prussic sizes if you use accessory cord. Whereas the Sterling, the auto block and the hollow block, you can use a 6 millimeter hollow block with 9 millimeter rope.
Hmm.
It works with a much wider range of rope diameters. So I'm a massive fan of using these new Sterling pre-sewn. They're made for Prussic. They're designed for Prussic. It's not just like the rope we get at Home Depot and we tie a double fisherman's in them.
Yeah. So
which works. but I'm certainly getting nerdy on this stuff right now.
Well, and if you're a raft guide, you're typically using different sizes of rope. So it probably makes sense to use that, where maybe if you're a kayaker and you know everyone has the NRS compact bag, figure out the diameter of that rope and get, you know, an accessory cord that will work for that.
Yeah.
So customize it as you will.
Yep. Yeah. But I'm just going to really push hard for these Sterling ones. I'm so stoked on them.
I'm going to check them out.
I'm so stoked on them. And I've had a lot of Prussic slip because we didn't have the right Prussic with us for the rope. And that becomes a problem. Where these work, every rope I've tried them on, they work. So it's nice to have a Prussic that works on a wide variety.
Awesome. Well, I guess we'll see you on the river, maybe.